So, to start with, Mordecai Breenberg, I learned something reading this, and I've known Mort for years, was born in Edmonton, where he graduated from the University of Alberta. This is the thing I learned. He was a member of the Conservative Party.
What?
I didn't know that. He went to Oxford for postgraduate study, where he became active in the anti-nuclear movement. And subsequently, he studied at the University of California, Berkeley, and where he also was active in the free speech and the anti-Vietnam War movements. Mordecai was hired in 1967 to teach at SFU. He was in what was known then as in the PSA department. It was an interesting and interdisciplinary approach, which people now mouth but don't quite understand in terms of the university administration. It was a combination of political science, sociology, and anthropology. He was elected chair of the department in 1969, 2 years after arriving, and 2 years after that, along with eight PSA faculty, he was fired by the Board of Governors. That firing and the organizing around it and since. Mordecai has lived and worked in Vancouver since he moved here in 67, and he's been continuously active in social justice movements and alternative media. So he's a lot to tell us about early SFU history.
For me, as Karen said, when I was in England, aside from my activity in the Conservative Party in Alberta, which was the progressive movement at the time, you may all chortle about that, but I won't go into that. I don't want to give an impression of absolute, unchanging political thinking on my part either. But the anti-nuclear movement was the main movement when I was in England. And there was, as there is today, a sense among the activists that we lived in imminent danger of the ending of all life on Earth. In my view, that remains a reality from that time to now. But consciousness of it is variable among people. But it was very much the consciousness of people, young people, which I was then, and so am not now. The other dimension, which was very important, was a liberatory dynamic, which was truly global. If you looked at the anti-colonial movement, if you looked at the revival of anti-slavery rebellion called civil rights movement, if you looked at women's rights, if you looked at the struggle for democratic rights, whether you were looking at Europe, East or West, whether you were looking at Asia, China in the midst of a cultural revolution, Africa, Latin America, and North America, these were really a lived sense that one was in a time of a liberatory dynamic. So we have the shadow in the sun. We have the sense of imminent catastrophe, the absolute urgency of avoiding that, and at the same time, an optimism and a sense that people's capacities to realize their own humanity was really energetically pursued globally. So coming to Simon Fraser, in my view, we have to look at how those global dynamics impact on a very small and tiny part of the world and a single institution within that tiny part of the world. This university, and you may well be aware of that, it was an instant university. It was established by the Social Credit Party, which was a right-wing populist party. And for them, it was a counter to the establishment domination of post-secondary education lodged in the University of British Columbia in UBC. So this was an institution which was designed to give a greater opportunity for working class children to attend post-secondary, those that have gone to work to come back and get an education more easily than the more privileged sectors of the society who just continue naturally on from their high school graduation into university at UBC at that time. It was established with an unstable mix of faculty, unstable in the sense of coming in particular from two different traditions. Most of the heads of departments and administration came out of, I would say, an English tradition, a British tradition, which was much more single person, ran the show kind of thing, and an American tradition, which was that faculty were some collective grouping who cooperatively ran the show without, of course, any involvement of students. So we had an institution which starts from scratch, which always creates possibilities for change and dynamic. It's unstable. The authority structures are not well consolidated. And as I said, we have people who are come with different expectations. So from the beginning, there were a series of student rebellions here at the Shell service station to try and preserve the scenery, really. That was sort of the extent of it at that time. There was an occupation of the administration building, which was on the grounds of the discrimination students felt that was imposed on working kids who were in other institutions who wanted to transfer to SFU. And they weren't given that opportunity fairly, so the students occupied the administration building, and that was where the administration called the RCMP in, and 114 were arrested, etc. There was student participation off campus, but it was at that time the major one was to be in alliance with a student who was being disciplined at a high school in the area, and by teachers who didn't like his poetry. We had faculty and administration conflicts, and in a situation where there was an overlap between faculty and administration conflicts over really trying to extend the opportunity for the American model of collegiality among faculty, and students were active, you can see that there is opportunity for things to go much further than either administration or faculty as a whole would be interested in supporting. And the place where they did go further than anywhere else in the university was in the political science, sociology, and anthropology department. This, as Karen said, combined social science department. And it became the focal point then of the, I would say, the decisive conflict in the shaping of this university for a generation. By generation, I mean a generation of faculty. So from the time they came here to the time they retired. It involved the government, it involved popular groups off campus, it involved national professional organizations, and in the end it consolidated a culture of political reaction with the defeat of what the PSA department had tried to establish. So what was it that sort of happened in the PSA department? The PSA department was the brainchild of a British academic who was appointed the first head of that department, Tom Bottomore. Tom Bottomore was what we would call an academic Marxist. He was interested in writing about Marx and in people reading Marx, etc., but not doing anything about their reading. And he had a very critical attitude towards social science in North America. So he proceeded to look for people who were critical of the dominant conservative social science teaching in North America. People, seeing him and the work that he had written as a Marxist, were attracted to him. But we were two different kinds of people, by and large, because he did not understand the dynamic that was taking place in North America between thinking and acting. And others of us didn't clear that he had a different perception between knowledge and the application of knowledge. So he hired people more radical than himself, and that set up a dynamic within the department. The department, through these various conflicts, Whatmore decided he'd had enough of Simon Fraser University, and he was going back to England. He hated the people he hired, and he was disgusted with the administration. And so there was sort of a vacuum in the department itself, among the faculty. And in that vacuum, which was, I would say, typical a bit of, as I'm saying, the conflicts between faculty and administration created certain instabilities. But it was consolidated in the instability was more, I would say, intense in the PSA department. In the absence of a strong authoritarian leader, which Whatmore was, the department, faculty, and students established a structure and a program for teaching which is as unprecedented in North America, was then and still is now. We established a form of decision making which was our understanding at that time of democracy. And it was, we called it a parallel parity structure. Now, parity between whom? There are three constituent elements in a university, in a university department. There are, of course, the students. There are the administrative or secretarial staff, and there are the faculty. We were not very successful, though it was our objective, that administrative staff, the secretarial staff, would be a part of this parallel parity structure. It worked in one limited area in dealing with their grievances. What did it mean? It meant parallel parity, that for every faculty committee, there would be a parallel student committee. And for a decision to be taken in that particular area, it could be hiring, it could be salary, it could be courses that are taught. All those areas are areas where faculty have committees, traditionally. And so now there was a student committee equal to, parallel to, the faculty committee. For a decision to be taken, it would have to have the agreement of the students and of the faculty. Were there to be no agreement, then a process of negotiation and ongoing discussion would take place, because that was necessary to try and achieve a common understanding. So if we were hiring new faculty, that was the way it would work. If you were deciding what curriculum to teach, that's the way it would work. Now, it was exhilarating for some faculty, because if you're trained as a faculty, you know, you've got a career orientation, you have a salary, you have a whole different material situation than a student. And truth be known, I think most faculty fear students. But for the majority of the PSA faculty, working in this structure gave them a much different appreciation. How many? 5 minutes? Okay. Much different appreciation of students. For many, it was transformative. It seemed to work. It worked in the classroom better. It worked in the meeting room better. Students from other departments kept changing their major. So the department kept growing. It became in that sense also a threat to other faculty because budget is allocated according to student enrollment, etc. The department also adopted a statement of principles. Now, what were these principles? The principles were, one is that we would teach a critical view of social science. We wrote it out. Most departments don't have statements of principle. We must tell the truth. We must tell the truth not only about what the powerful regard as useful, but about important controversial issues. We must shrink neither from the conclusions of our criticism nor from conflict with the powerful. We are social critics. We seek to understand society in its totality and to reveal the relations and dynamic of that totality. We see within each social order the possibility of going beyond that social order. We identify, analyze, and so help to overcome obstacles to the realization of human liberation. That was one point of guidance for how we would teach. Second, democratic control, and I've explained that a bit in terms of the parallel parity structure. And third, and extremely important as all, but the least developed in practice, it was community integration. The university is not neutral on social questions. The work of most social scientists serves the interests of the wealthy and powerful. We will contribute our energies to solve the problems of workers, not the problem with workers, problems of Native peoples, not the problem with Native peoples, the problems of welfare recipients, not the problems with welfare recipients, the problems of youth, not the problems with youth. If you're in government and you have a social science department with that program, and you want to develop a university that facilitates what they called in that day Pacific Rim investment, you want to get rid of these people. And so that was what it was about. So the university took over the department. We went on strike. We were on strike for 6 weeks. I think it was the longest strike other than the University of San Francisco. We lost the strike. We were fired for going on strike, and we had a number of hearings by arbitration boards. We won all of them unanimously. Our nominee supported us, their nominee supported us, and the appointed nominee of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of British Columbia supported us. In the end, the university said, the administration, on I'm convinced instructions of the government, said, we gave you the arbitration hearing. It was a kind of gesture of goodwill, but nobody's entitled to it, and fuck off. And that was the end. So that was the end of the PSA department. What can be learned from that is up to you to decide. The past is not a guidebook to the present. It's a set of contradictions and realities that we can ponder. But we have to analyze it in terms of what we can learn, in terms of how we analyze our present circumstance. Thank you.
Thank you.